probably better.
Yeah, I might not talk for very long. Give us something to say.
Thank you all for coming on a very cold, dark Monday evening to the celebration of Asymptote's 4th anniversary in praise of translation. As an online journal, we at Asymptote hardly ever get to meet our readers, so it's wonderful to see so many of you here tonight. Extremely pleased to have a full house. Before we get started, I'd like to remind you all to please turn off your phones, so we don't, or at least on silent. And very importantly, I'd like to thank the Free Word Centre for all their generosity and for letting us use this wonderful venue for the second year running. Now, before I introduce and hand over to our very exciting panel of speakers tonight, I'll just spend a couple of minutes talking about Asymptote. I hope that many or even most of you are already readers of the journal, but for the benefit of those who may not be, I'm going to play a very short animated introduction to the magazine. This was put together on the occasion of our second anniversary a couple of years ago.
George Bernard Shaw once said something like, "If you have an apple, and I've got one too, and we exchange these apples, then you and I will still only have one apple. But if you have an idea, and I have another one, and we exchange those ideas, then each of us will have two ideas." Similarly, works of art, such as poems or short stories, have the potential to affect millions. And like with apples, we'll never run out. This potential to reach just anyone, however, can be seriously limited by linguistic barriers. That's where Asymptote comes in. Our mission is simple: to unlock the literary treasures of the world. In our 9 issues, we have published work from more than 70 countries, translated from more than 50 different languages. We don't just give our readers the chance to discover these translations, they also get to see the originals and listen to the way they sound.
Una heter ett träd som växte I en by mellan två av älvdalarna, nedanför fjällen.
이야기하는 사람과 이야기를 듣는 사람들이 있다.
And we don't only translate into English. We commission translations into other languages as well. Being an international team means working in different time zones with no physical office. And, more importantly, no support from any national grants. While perhaps impractical, this means we do have a wider reach and are able to team up with local journals to bring you the best writing from all over. Being an online journal means that anyone with an internet connection can read any piece we've ever published for free. Now, on the occasion of our second anniversary, we are holding our first live events in 9 different cities. By organising these panel discussions and meetings, we want to highlight the important role that translators play in opening up world literature. In all our work so far, and all our plans for the future, our aim is to share great writing from anywhere to anyone. If you like what we're doing, please consider donating to our cause today. The future of our non-profit depends on readers like you.
So that's just a very quick taste of what we're committed to as a magazine. Whether publishing the best and newest literature in translation, acting as a catalyst for literary work that demands social change, or organising events like this one, everything we do is in the name of spurring the transmission of literature to promote a truly global conversation. Our team of now more than 50 editors all around the globe puts us in a great position to make this happen. Although our founder and editor-in-chief, Yuliong Li, lives in Taipei and so unfortunately can't be here tonight in person, the Asymptote team is represented by Emma Jacobs, one of our assistant editors, who's at the back. Give us a wave, Emma. commissioning editor James Tennant, who's behind the camera. We also have editor-at-large for Slovakia, Julia Sherwood, who I think is at the back. There you are. And editor-at-large for Taiwan, Vivian Chi. Who is at the back? Yes, great. And myself, I'm Ellen Jones. I realised I didn't introduce myself earlier. I'm the criticism editor for Asymptote. Please do stick around afterwards, have a drink and say hello to us. We'd love to talk to you, and we're all wearing these very fetching name tags so you can identify us. Last year, thanks to our readers' overwhelming support, we raised over $20,000 in donations, which went towards building a new daily blog and a clickable map, which allows readers to navigate our extensive archives by country and language. It also funded Close Approximations, our contest for emerging translators, which was judged by Elliot Weinberger and Howard Goldblatt, and which awarded a total of $3,000 in prize money. This year, we need your help once again, and we would ask you to take a moment to visit our Indiegogo crowdfunding page. In case you're wondering what we're raising money for this time, we're committed to running a second edition of the translation contest, as well as continuing our current publishing cycle, and running more events just like this one. The campaign closes on January the 29th, so you've got a little bit of time to check out our mission statement and the great perks that we're offering, some of which you can see up there. Finally, I'd encourage everyone to live tweet this event, if you're on Twitter, with a hashtag in praise of translation. Now, it only remains to introduce our panel of speakers. Firstly, second here, we're delighted to have Stefan Tobler chairing the discussion this evening. Stefan is the publisher at And Other Stories, a young publishing house whose titles include the Booker Prize shortlisted Swimming Home by Deborah Levy and A Wealth of Literature and Translation. Stefan himself translates from Portuguese and German, with recent titles including All Dogs Are Blue by Rodrigo de Souza Leal, Agua Viva by Clarice Lispector, and Silence River by Antonio Maura. Adam Thirlwell, next to Stefan, has twice been selected one of Granter's best young British novelists. His new novel, Lurid and Cute, will be published early this year. Adam also edited a fascinating translation project called Multiples, which was published in 2007 by Jonathan Cape and then continued in an issue of McSweeney's Quarterly Concern. Adam's work has been translated into 30 languages. Daniel Hahn, in the blue here, is a writer, editor, and translator from Portuguese, Spanish, and French, with over 40 books to his name. His work has won both the Independent Foreign Fiction Prize and the Blue Peter Book Award. He is currently chair of the Society of Authors and on the judging panel for the 2015 Impact Dublin Award. And last but not least, on the end we have Deborah Smith, who is the translator of The Vegetarian by Korean author Han Kang, who we're delighted to have with us in the audience tonight. Han Kang's novel will be published by Portobello Books this year. Deborah is currently in the final year of her PhD in Korean literature at SOAS and is setting up a non-profit publishing house which will publish translations from Asian and African languages, having apprenticed with Stefan at And Other Stories. So can we please wish all of our speakers a very warm welcome and then over to Stefan.
Very much. It's really great to be invited, for all of us, I think, to be invited here, because we get to do something that you don't always get the chance to do, which is just to talk about one book we like a lot. Those four books that we're going to talk about are all translations, and then we're going to have a chance to talk first amongst ourselves and then with you too about translation in general. Literatures from other places and how they come here and things we're excited about, and you are too. So we've each chosen one book, and Adam Thirlwell's going to introduce his first. He knows exactly what he's going to say. Go on, you.
Okay, this is like a game show suddenly. The book that I'm going to talk about very briefly is by Daniel Sada, the Mexican novelist, and it's called Almost Never, translated by Catherine Silva. And the translation came out in 2012, and it's a 2008 novel. Very briefly, just to tell you about Daniel Sada, he was a Mexican novelist who died in 2011. In the rather poignant bio note, the last line of it is, just hours before he died, he was awarded Mexico's most prestigious literary award, the National Prize for Arts and Sciences for Literature. And I partly wanted to kind of talk about it, partly because it was a book that I find kind of amazing. And I think it's an interesting example as well of the sort of economics of translation, that it's the only book of his to be in English. And certainly is obviously considered to be his most accessible as well. And that Francisco Goldman, who's in fact the reason why I read it, he told me about this book, in a rather lovely kind of blurb, says that Sade is to Juan Rulfo what Beckett was to Joyce, only inverted. Sade's maximalism was his response to Rulfo's unsurpassable minimalism. And it's that kind of Baroque crazy energy that I adored, but that also is, I would have thought, a nightmare to translate. And maybe I'll talk about that briefly, but the idea was that, I think I might just read the first paragraph,
that would be great.
Which I have to apologize, is kind of dirty. but actually, I'm going to stop before it gets too dirty. But that's not unrepresentative of this really quite dirty novel. This is the first paragraph. Sex as an apt pretext for breaking the monotony. Motor sex, anxiety sex, the habit of sex as any glut that can well become a burden. Colossal, headlong, frenzied, ambiguous sex as a game that baffles, then enlightens, then baffles again. Pretense sex, see-through sex. Pleasure in the end as praise that goes against the grain of life lived. Conjectures cut short during a walk on a pale afternoon. Block after block, ascending, then descending. A strain in the step as well as the mind. The subject was one Demetrio Sordo, tall and thin, almost 30, fond of the countryside where he plied his trade with a modicum of pleasure. But for recreation, what thrills? Nightly games of dominoes in seedy dives, and those strolls, few and quite dull, of a mere mile or two, or a cup of coffee in the evening, always solitary and perfectly pointless, or the penning of letters to known but already ghostly beings. Hence a rut. And what should he do? Think? Already anticipating certainties and doubts, lots of naysaying and more reshuffling, all of which helped him find the spark he'd been lacking without taxing his brain on that overcast afternoon. Sex was the most obvious option. But the trick would be to do it every 24 hours, if only. A worthy disbursement indeed. So that very night, the agronomist went looking for a brothel. He went hesitantly. His mincing steps gave him away. He descended from the taxi and began walking as if on eggshells or as if the soles of his feet were being shredded by shards of glass. He found himself almost smack in the middle of the red light district, which was not even remotely Edenic and, to make matters worse, was dimly illuminated. This was only the second time he'd visited such an inferno, so he didn't know where to go. Casting about, the first thing he saw was a row of scruffy-looking women in ironwood rocking chairs, each one next to the open door of her own mean hovel. A sordid spectacle stretching along the sidewalk he had started down. Those mincing steps quickly turned into long strides, a sensible sprint motivated by his wish to find a high-class brothel. He stopped and asked a passerby. The man willingly obliged, that one over there or the other farther on, those are the costliest. Then came an exchange regarding the prostitutes he'd find in each. There were all kinds, though Demetrio preferred not to listen to more descriptions and instead took off a pace without so much as a thank you. And there they were, one brothel named La Entretenida and the other Presuncion, two yellow buildings like lumpy quadrangles that lent a touch of lustre to the twilight. So which would it be? A pleasant, somewhat extended quandary. He chose Presuncion. They charged an entrance fee as if it were a museum, a bit of a stretch. Then came a diffident handing over of cash. In exchange, the promise of instant happiness to ward off the gloom, for everything he'd so far fleetingly observed had made an impression, as did the grandeur of the suggestive orange-tinted salon with its many empty armchairs. There was piped-in music, but no dance floor. Ranchera music, exclusively, and ever so loud. And that's the first paragraph. And I suppose, I feel very much like the unqualified person on this panel, as the only person who's not a translator, but is just a novelist. One of the things that I think is interesting, I've always been much more influenced, I think, by works in translation than, or in other languages, than I have been by probably British literature, certainly. And one of the things that I think is to find kind of forms that aren't actually kind of there in kind of, you know, one of the key things I think about translation is to kind of find literary forms that don't exist in just your own language. And for me, Sade is a really interesting example of a kind of, partly the baroqueness of the kind of, this compact, huge paragraph. So this is a very different way of introducing a novel than certainly a kind of, I think, a British novelist would feel comfortable with. And also I think what really interests me, maybe in a lot of Latin American literature, is the way sort of philosophy or thought and kind of narrative can intersect. So that a lot of these novels are kind of trains of thought in the forms of novels. And that's one of the things that is interesting here, because it is just a massive long sort of block of language. So that's why I chose this one.
Thank you. That is a long train of thought. And this, and is, are the sent, does he carry on sort of, are the sentences sort of...
Basically, the, his unit in this novel, I don't know if this is in all the novels, is a kind of, it's slightly stil and direct libris, slightly interior monologue, so that you are always very closely tracking Dimitri's progress. And Dimitri's progress is basically to choose between whether or not he really prefers the, it's set in kind of rural desert Mexico in about 1945, and it's really about who he will marry, or more importantly, that he is half in love with a very upright, correct young lady who lives in a very repressed society, sort of village society, Renata, who is a virgin and very, you know, gets upset when she even kisses her hand on the third occasion. As opposed to the whores that he is also in love with in the various brothels of Mexico. And so he's constantly in a kind of tug between this. But the kind of, so the intro, I mean, and the plot literally finishes on his wedding night, that he finally gets to have sex with Renata. That's the plot of this very long novel.
You're saying it wasn't a particularly, because the cover has an upside down cross on, and Adam was saying it wasn't particularly religious. It sounds very Catholic to me.
Yeah, I guess so. But I mean, what you realise, the interest is the form, as it were, that the plot is so minimal, and around it there is this colossal kind of outpouring of 400 pages of, and relentlessness is, I think, the figure you think of, that it's just constantly this sort of I don't know, just a way of describing a thought process and a kind of obsession, so that actually you realise that gradually the kind of experience of reading and the experience of sort of anticipation that he's having in the novel become the same thing. So rather amusingly, the literal last line is simply a one-line sentence, which is sheer relief. and there's definitely a way in which this is, I think, meant to be actually a kind of, the novel is an image of itself, as it were, that there is a kind of, that there is some kind of blockage being expressed by the style.
Sounds brilliant. I'm looking forward to reading it.
We know how it ends, though.
So we do, yeah. I have given away the...
I'll give it a few years and forget. Yeah. Deborah, would you like to tell us about your book next?
Sure. So I've chosen a book called, in the English translation, The Girl with the Golden Parasol, which looks like this. It's by a Hindi novelist called Uday Prakash, and the translator is Jason Grunbaum. It was originally published in India, in Hindi, in 2001. And then Jason's translation was published in 2008, but only in India. And then it took another 5 years until this publisher, which is it's Yale University Press, and it's their Margellos World Literature imprint, chose to release it in the US as well. So it's had a bit of a wait to get through to a wider audience there. And I chose it partly because, for, you know, similar reasons to everyone else here, I like the book, I like the translation, I like it a lot. But also, I was struck by something that I heard the translator say, which was that this was the only Hindi translation published by a press in the US or the UK. He said a generation. It was, you know, decades since someone had last published a Hindi translation. And I'm pretty sure that the one that was brought out before wasn't by a contemporary writer, which Uday is. So I was excited by the prospect of being able to read something from a language where I hadn't read, I don't think, anything else from Hindi. And also something that was up to the minute. So I will read a couple of paragraphs on it. The look of the Hindi department today was utterly different. It was as if a sick old-fashioned Brahmin dressed in dirty rags, the kind who carries out holy rituals in Haridwar or Allahabad, had just returned from a spa, suddenly cured, now a brand new man, after enjoying a steam bath, facial, colour treatment, and full cosmetic makeover. Now he's wearing a snazzy checkered shirt, a smiling old swami. Or
It was like the rich old count from Tolstoy's story who preens himself before departing for the grand evening fete, affixing the special spring-loaded wig to keep his drooping face lifted up, and, arriving at the party, flirts with the beautiful, wily and available young women who burn with the lust of unbridled social ambition. And I'm going to skip a little bit. That's when the scene took shape. First one real, worldly, human foot emerged out of the open door of the Black Ambassador, then another. He wore a white dhoti made of homespun and matching black natural fibre sandals. His fingers were spread. He had dark, shiny legs, greasy, as if he'd been rubbing them with ghee. As soon as those feet touched the ground, the uneasy, half-closed eyes on Dr. Loknathupathy's round, pudgy face gave the signal. It was as if his eyebrows danced for a moment on his forehead. Padma Shri, Dr. Rajendra Tiwari, was the first to reverentially touch the esteemed feet. After him, it was Dr. Shukla's turn, followed by Jasaheb Pandiji and Dr. Pant. Dr. Vajpayee polished those dark hooves with his excited forehead. Dr. Agrawal scoured the feet with his nose and cheeks. Dr. Dangwal combed his hair with those holy toes. Then came the turn of the students, who put on a surrealistic scene. At the turn of the 21st century, this was an extremely authentic and original postmodern view of Hindi literature. So I chose those two little sections there because I think it shows, you know, why I enjoyed the book particularly and why I think Jason's translation really works. Is that one of the interesting things about this book was that the sort of the style or the structure or the narrative modes are quite different from what you would find in a lot of Indian writing in English that hasn't been translated. So it's quite meandering. He will, like from the beginning bit that I read there, he will describe something. You would expect it to then sort of move on. Instead, almost as though he sort of thought of a better way of putting it, he'll then describe it again. It's a lot of the events, on the other hand, aren't really that developed. So it's almost as if the events are there for him to describe, to give descriptions. And he really sort of gets into the descriptions. He really has a sort of strident but also acerbic, you know, comically skewering these characters, almost like kind of reminded me of Tristram Shandy, that last bit when he's describing the Hindi literature doyen getting out of the car. And I should explain as well, the whole novel, which is not very long, is it's a campus novel, basically. It's these cosmopolitan Indian kids who are stuck out in this university in the sticks. And the hero is from a lower caste, from the girl that he falls in love with. And she is studying in the Hindi literature department, which is why he changes his major, and then discovers that Hindi literature is, or the way that it's taught, the way that it's sort of systematized in the universities is completely caste-ridden. And it's a very nationalistic issue for them, and it's kind of the way that the author, who has actually had a lot of criticism from people in India about what he's written and about the way that he writes Hindi, because he uses a lot of sort of street slang, whereas in this book he explains how, because Hindi has become sort of yoked to this Hindu nationalism, people have very strong ideas of, you know, its purity and how it should be used. And the way that he's trying to incorporate the way that he actually hears people, especially people from lower castes, speaking it, has come under fire there. So, yeah, I thought it's a great book. It's a great translation because Jason sort of really captures the comedy. He keeps it quite foreign as well. There's a lot of Hindi that he doesn't translate, and, you know, even things like names of flowers, of food, the kind of thing that you might expect to be, especially in translations from
underrepresented languages to be italicized or, you know, God forbid, to have footnotes, which would just be horrific. He doesn't do that. And it's because I think, unlike, again, a lot of the Indian writing in English, the implied reader in this one is explicitly Indian. You know, he is writing to an audience that knows this. And at first, when I sort of read this, I wondered why the translator had chosen to sort of not contextualize a bit more, to not Americanize, because this was published in America. But then actually I thought, you know, it's one of the points of reading books in translation is why should we only read what has been written for us? Because who is us anyway? I think one of the reasons that I became a translator in the first place was because I read more translated fiction than I read British fiction, because actually I found a lot of that less alien and less other than the kind of mainstream Booker Prize, you know, which actually has quite a narrow implied audience, but doesn't always know it has, or doesn't always think it has. It has a, you know, it has an implied audience of the kind of middle-class people whose lives are represented in a lot of Booker novels, and, you know, the vast majority of other people who definitely do read literary fiction don't necessarily feel themselves included in that us. And so reading books from around the world where, you know, you're not expected to identify or feel the same or recognize yourself, I think is, yeah, refreshing. Mm.
Thanks, Deborah. That's a, it's a, it's a, I hope it's not true that that is the only translation from Hindu in a generation.
Well,
but it's,
there is now another of Jason's translations.
That's good.
Of the same writer.
Things are moving in the right direction.
Yeah. So there's two now.
It's a flood.
Yeah.
We're inundated.
Yeah. Well, I have. We're going to leave Daniel till last because it's sort of going to come back to Deborah again. But I have a book which I don't know if any of you know. It's a book of poetry. And before I actually tell you more about it, I'll just read the very beginning. One, apricot trees exist. Apricot trees exist. That is the first poem. Two, bracken exists and blackberries, blackberries. Bromine exists and hydrogen, hydrogen. That is the second poem. And the third is cicadas exist, chicory, chromium, citrus trees. Cicadas exist, cicadas, cedars, cypresses, the cerebellum. And as you might not be surprised to find out, the book is called Alphabet by Inger Christensen, a Danish poet. And I have two editions here, in fact. This was the one I first bought, which is the Blood Axe edition, the UK edition. And then this is the US New Directions edition, which I sort of ended up owning again because I bought it from Tara, who became my wife. So now I have both editions in a way. As you can see, I really do like this book. I like it for many reasons, and I think it is a book which just the sound of it is incredible. The rhythms and the form of it, which I'll say a bit more about, but also what it talks about is both something that the poet has really thought about and just expresses in a lovely way. The book is really about the natural world, you know, in all its glory and variety, and also about the words we use to talk about it and about our experience of it. So there's a lot of lightness. There's a lot of in many ways it's a hymn to the world, but at the same time it's there's sort of an obverse, which is that it's a bit of an elegy, because the poem was written in 91 when people were very much thinking about, you know, atomic nuclear war and the atom bomb and the possible destruction of everything, which makes you think about what you have too, I suppose. And the poem manages to somehow spread out into the whole world through its form, because the form is, there are two things that she's taken as constraints. One is the alphabet. So the first poem is with A, the second poem with B, third poem with C, and so on until we get to N. But the other constraint is that she takes the Fibonacci sequence to determine the number of lines that each poem has. So just in case your math is a little bit rusty, in the Fibonacci sequence, as you will remember, you get each number in the sequence is the sum of the previous two numbers in the sequence. So if her first poem is one line and the second poem is two lines, the third poem is the sum of one and two is three lines, and then the fourth poem is the sum of two and three is five, and then the next one is three and five, eight. Which sounds okay at the beginning, but by the time you get to M, you're at 377 lines, which might be one reason why she decided to only go halfway through the alphabet. But you could say it perhaps had something to do with the theme too, in just we're thinking of the atom bomb and half-lives and radiation. And inside the longer poems, then it's also divided up into blocks, into stanzas, which are mainly also Fibonacci numbers. Now, this might sound like some sort of very clever trick, but it does feel like it fits. For one thing, it allows the poem to expand in a way that you can understand how it's happening, but at the same time, you don't quite know what's going to happen because you're not counting the lines as you go. And then the Fibonacci sequence itself seems fitting, because the Fibonacci sequence, as you might also know, it has the golden ratio in it, so that if you would do draw it geometrically, the increasing blocks of the one and the two and three and the five and the eight, you go around and you get the spiral, which has the golden ratio in it, which is present in a lot of natural things, such as the whirl of a nautilus shell, or the unfolding fern, the frond of a fern, which of course is you have the bracken fern in her poem at the bee. So there's, I think, anyway, that's sort of what she found to help her write it. But really, just it's something that you have to read. And I thought actually it'd be really nice to hear Inger Christensen read the very first poem. This is on a great site that has lots of poets reading and translations. It's called Lyric Line. It's worth a look. It's German, which is why it's got a K in the lyric.
Aprikostræerne findes, aprikostræerne findes.
And you can hear her read more at your leisure. We'll maybe leave it for now. I don't want to. Yeah. I'm sure I could listen to her all night, but anyway. I wanted to say something briefly about the translation, because it's a poem where the translation is obviously going to be quite a challenge. Firstly, it was a challenge to get it published. It was, the original came out in 1981, and the translator, Susanna Nied, N-I-E-D, she was already translating Inger Christensen's work, and she immediately started translating it, and she put it in for a US Pen Poetry Award as an unpublished translation, and it won that in 1982. But no one came along and published it until, in fact, this edition came out in 2000, followed closely by this one in 2001. So it must have been pretty horrible for the amount of work to translate a poem that's so based on the physicality of words and their sounds and the letter they begin with. To then have to wait that long. But luckily, it did come out. There's actually a great interview with the poet online. If you sort of Google, alphabet translation, it'll come up. It's in a magazine online called Circumference Magazine. It's a bit like Asymptote, but just for poetry, I think. It does translations. So I would recommend that. And what I did find fascinating, and then I'll stop after that, but I think quite a few of you are interested in the nuts and bolts of how the translation happens. And one thing that I thought sort of interesting reading it, even in the second one, you heard Bracken exists and blackberries, bromine exists, and hydrogen, and the hydrogen obviously doesn't have a B. And so you sort of wonder as you read, well, does this word or does that word have a B or a D or a K or whatever it is in the Danish? And sometimes they don't, but sometimes they do. And in this case, hydrogen does have a B in Danish. It's something or other like Brinton. Did the translator think of finding a B word that isn't hydrogen, but then it's about the atom bomb, so you need hydrogen. And I just thought, rather than give you any sort of particular sort of take on it, I might just give you what the translator herself wrote, or said in an interview last year in a magazine called the Denver Quarterly. And I think it's quite interesting, the choice that she and the poet made, bearing in mind also that the poet was also an acclaimed translator. She translated Virginia Woolf and Porcelain and other people into Danish. And so Susanna Nide says about this question of sound and meaning. She says, it is tricky. I guess my rule of thumb is that meaning has to trump everything else. But it's not an unbreakable rule, in part because meaning and form do not separate neatly. They're interwoven. One has to be careful not to get so carried away with recreating form that one dilutes the meaning. When these issues come up, I do a lot of conferring with the poet, whichever poet she's translating. She or he always gets final say. Inga almost always preferred that I use whichever English word most accurately conveyed meaning. For that reason, many of the alphabet translations have fewer words starting with the right letter than the Danish originals have. And I just thought that was fascinating, that a poem that was so much based on this constraint, the poet was willing to loosen that up and let the translation not necessarily follow the constraint in every single word. And I don't know, I suppose ultimately I think that's sort of what happens with a lot of translations, that as translators and as readers, you at the same time you sort of feel it's, you can sort of see another poem there that isn't quite there. There's sort of an imperfection in a way, I think, that translators often feel, but at the same time you sort of don't mind because it's just such a wonderful thing. That's that one. But now we're going to look at a translation that is not imperfect.
No, it's a perfect translation. We're going to look at a perfect translation, and I haven't got any quotes from the translator because I've brought the translator with me, as it happens, rather conveniently. This is a slightly humiliating thing to have to do because I'm going to talk about a book translated by someone who's about 2 meters away from me, which I did know when I agreed, when I chose this book. I didn't realise that the author was also going to be in the room. So I'm just going to pretend they're not here, especially at the bit when I actually read their book to them. This is slightly foolish. It's the book which Ellen mentioned at the beginning. It's The Vegetarian by Han Kang and translated by Deborah, which I have chosen because it is, in fact, I think, the best and most interesting translation I've read in a while, and not... I was going to say not even partly, because Deborah's here with me. One of the things we say when we talk about translation, especially to people who need the point of translation explained to them, we talk in a very vague and slightly thoughtless way, I think, about it opening up new worlds to us and new perspectives, and it's a way of getting access to new things. I think what Adam said about new forms is true, but I also think it's a very novelisty kind of way of reading too. I think you acquire slightly different things as a novelist to civilians. But I think it's, you know what I mean. But I think it's also true that while you read translated fiction in order to get things that may be different from what you can get at home, you also have access to them because they're also familiar, what Deborah was, she talked about recognition. So The Vegetarian is a book set in a country I don't know, and it's set in a culture I don't know, which has structures I don't know, and which has taboos that I don't recognise as the same that we have. And so in that sense, it should be somehow very distant. It should be somehow quite removed from my understanding of things. But actually, of course, it's a book about people's responsibilities to one another. It's a book about change. It's a book about sex. It's a book about lots of things that are beyond or beneath the kind of structural or the cultural or the kind of circumstantial things that make up this book. It's a story, very briefly, of a woman who decides she's going to be vegetarian. And this very simple and very straightforward decision, I can't believe I'm trying not to catch the eye of the author, it's slightly embarrassing. If I say anything really idiotic, just kind of turn away. It's about a woman who announces she's going to be vegetarian, she tells her husband this, and slowly everything around her unspools. Relationships, families, all of these structures on which are drawn very economically in the book before we watch them unspool. And it's about all of the kind of surprising and dramatic and quite dark ramifications of this announcement she's made. I'm going to read the very beginning and the very end and then just say something about the translation very quickly, I think. I'm also going to show it to you. Oh, you have it there. The colours aren't quite... It's an amazing jacket, such an amazing jacket, with French flaps and everything. We love this book. I'm going to read the very beginning and the very end. I'm going to change one word at the end for reasons of spoilers and things. But I'm going to read, as I say, two very short pieces, mostly because of the difference between the writing in the two of them. And Deborah has to not listen. Before my wife turned vegetarian, I'd always thought of her as completely unremarkable in every way. To be frank, the first time I met her, I wasn't even attracted to her. Middling height, bobbed hair, neither long nor short, jaundiced, sickly-looking skin, somewhat prominent cheekbones. Her timid, sallow aspect told me all I needed to know. As she came up to the table where I was waiting, I couldn't help but notice her shoes. The plainest black shoes imaginable, and that walk of hers, neither fast nor slow, striding nor mincing. However, if there wasn't any special attraction, nor did any particular drawbacks present themselves, and therefore there was no reason for the two of us not to get married. The passive personality of this woman, in whom I could detect neither freshness nor charm, or anything especially refined, suited me down to the ground. That's the first 10 lines or so. You can tell me how to pronounce these names.
Young here and in here.
In here. I'll do my best, but I apologise. This is the last couple of paragraphs. Then In here opens her mouth. What I'm trying to say, she whispers to Young here. The chassis rattles over a hollow in the road. Inhier squeezes Junghair's shoulders. Perhaps this is all a kind of dream. She bows her head. But then, as though suddenly struck by something, she brings her mouth right up to Junghair's ear and carries on speaking, forming the words carefully, one by one. I have dreams too, you know. Dreams, and I could let myself dissolve into them, let them take me over. But surely the dream isn't all there is? We have to wake up at some point, don't we? Because then she raises her head again. They're rounding the last bend in the road, leaving Mount Chuxiong. She sees a black bird flying up toward the dark clouds. The summer sunlight dazzles her eyes, makes them sting, and her gaze cannot follow the bird's flight anymore. Quietly, she breathes in. The trees by the side of the road are blazing, green fire undulating like the rippling flanks of a massive animal, wild and savage. In here stares fiercely at the trees, as if waiting for an answer, as if protesting against something. The look in her eyes is dark and insistent. The end. One of the things, I obviously don't speak Korean, I have not read this novel, so in one sense I have no idea whether this is a good translation.
Good.
What I can, I'm sure it's not. I have, I'm sure it's an absolute travesty. But what I can tell, all I can do is I can consume this as a reader of English, and all I can tell is that there is something about this piece of English writing that Deborah has done. And I wanted to read that beginning and that end because of the difference between the two and because of the precision you can see what's happening in the language in the two. It may be that there is something quite different happening in the text that is behind it that I can't read, but what I can tell from the English is somehow the writing, the texture of the language, is doing exactly what it needs to do at each of the different moments it needs to do it. The kind of rhythms of the prose change quite a lot in the book, and they change in ways that are exactly appropriate for what the book is doing. So in a funny way, Stefan was talking about imperfection. In a funny way, I can't tell you if this is a good translation, but I can tell you that this is sort of a perfect translation in that it is clearly doing something that works. A friend of mine was explaining a really good piece of writing to me not long ago, and he said, it's one of those things where, you know, kind of Pratt Crit would work on it. In other words, if you actually were to analyse it as a piece of practical criticism, the bits where the words are short are the bits where you want the kind of effect where the words are short, and the bits where the pace is doing something are the bits where you would want that. Everything is absolutely appropriate. And it's really lovely to read a piece of English. As I say, I have no access to the thing that it came from, but which feels like the writing in English is so controlled to suit the different voices, to suit the characters, to suit the changing pace of the book. And it's great, and you should read it. And Deborah's very clever.
Four books that we all have to read, I think. But one thing I thought was interesting was that we've all chosen books. I mean, I originally was going to look for a book, you know, in from Portuguese or German or, you know, something I translate from, and you know, something I could, you know, maybe say something about the translation. But we've all, I don't know, do you read Spanish in Spanish?
No, I read Spanish.
So I think we've all chosen something that we haven't actually got a clue how the original compares to the translation. And yet we have a sense that these, you know, that these are books that work. Did you find any, I mean, Danny, you said it, you know, that convinced you, you know, the book in itself. Did either of you sort of have a worry that you couldn't read the original, or?
Well, I think there's an interesting theme, like kind of, I think there's a lot less difference between original writing, as it were, and translation writing. They're often seen, I think the kind of cliche is that, well, the cliche is that the translation, as it were, is never finished. The reason why we always retranslate is that, you know, it's never definitive. And I actually sort of disagree. I think there are definitive translations where I feel there's no need to do it again. And also that actually the same problem is at work, which is a problem of authority, that basically it's exactly like a lot of the technical problems of writing a novel come down to something very amorphous, which is, can you establish the authority to tell this story in the way you want to tell it? And actually it's very visible very early whether the reader is going to go with you or not. And it seems to me that it's actually the same kind of thing we've been talking about here, is that because there is always this gap where, especially when it's a language you don't, I think there's an interesting difference between reading a translation in a language you speak and reading one where you don't speak that language. The problem is authority, and I certainly feel that with, say, Catherine Silver's translation here, where the problem of Sada is this kind of manic change of register and tone and syntax and sentence structure. And the danger would be that it sounds like it's just mistranslated all the time. And I think she takes a lot of risks, which I think are very, you know, amazing. Like, she's constantly going with kind of crazy American slang and kind of, but then mixed with high kind of Latinate English. And
And that really interests me because I think it's actually to establish your authority in that. It's very similar to what you're describing here, is to have more than one style in a translation is actually very difficult because people might think you've gone wrong.
In a way that you wouldn't think that of a writer.
Exactly.
You wouldn't read the first paragraph of a writer and think, this person can't do sentences.
Yeah. Well, I actually had this recently, well, not a few years ago, where as a kind of mini translation experiment, I did a translation of Carlo Emilio Gadda, the Italian novelist, which I did, speaking almost no Italian, I did with an Italian novelist who is fluent in English. And so we did a kind of joint translation. And it was a very similar style to Sada's in the sense of these kind of tonal shifts, and you know the Gadda's range is extraordinary in the same paragraph. And then we sent it. I sent it to Lauren Stein, who edits the Paris Review, and it was very interesting. Where he came back to me and said, "This is fascinating because if you'd sent this to me as an original story, I'd think this was a kind of masterly kind of thing. Whereas because I know it's a translation and I know you speak no Italian, I am kind of like the things that would seem if it was an original thing." Brilliant acrobatics of style seem now like potential translation ease and a mistake. And it was a very interesting, that establishment of authority seems to be the biggest problem.
Yeah, no, I think that is interesting. It is very easy for translation, sort of the translation to be the thing that the reviewer takes it out on. If the reviewer doesn't like the novel, then it can be the... It's always the translation's fault, isn't it?
But you also conversely do get, like you're writing, you do get in a translation, you heard two of these, you heard openings, and you can tell in both of those cases, immediately within two sentences, you think, right, safe hands. There is a confidence which, especially, I'll stop talking about it in a second, but for a first book, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But there is a kind of confidence, and there are certain books, even, and this can sometimes actually rescue an original novel, which is not... quite up to it, having a translator who is so confident and so assured, and where everything has this amazing kind of control and versatility, and as you said, sometimes even acrobatics. Finding that in an opening paragraph is an enormously pleasing sense that there is this. It is again to do with authority. There is this person who you absolutely know; they know what they're doing, and you just sit down and let them do it.
Is there a related question, I think, of contemporary translations? I'm just interested that you've worked, presumably, quite closely with the author, you know, that there she is.
And,
and Danny, I remember we had this conversation as well, where you were saying the kind of, we were having an argument, I was saying, why aren't translators, as it were, more kind of crazy with the form? And it's just, I think, interesting, that thing you say, in a way, I feel like I wish, in a way, the form had been preserved more. And then I'm intrigued that, in a sense, that has the... Obviously, it's because the author is saying, well, I want this. And so, I don't know, just...
I think in this case, it's interesting. I mean, that was my... I have to say, that was my first thought. I was like, well, why, you know, why didn't she, you know, really go with form? But the thing is, when you read the poem, of course, you realise that it's just not all about the constraints that are there. And so, it did surprise me at first, but I think... Interestingly, there's a note at the beginning of the Blood X one that says... says something along the lines of no other translations will be allowed. so they were obviously sure that they did want one.
Which I mean
I think actually is a shame. I would love there to be 10 different translations of this poem. But having said that, the amount of time the translator spent on this and worked with the poet, I think it'd be hard to beat.
Deborah, would you have been freer or differently free if your author, pretend she's not here again, if your author hadn't been around, available, reading, talking to you, would you have felt a different kind of responsibility then?
No, I think it would have been the opposite. I think I would have felt less free, especially, as you said, doing a first book, and for, you know, an editor like every other editor at a UK or presumably US publishing house who cannot read the original and has to just trust that my translation is accurately, whatever that means, representing the original. I can't prove that, you know, a choice that I've made is the correct choice. But I was lucky enough that Hangang really appreciates translation as a creative act, as a kind of creative writing. And also the fact that Korean and English, just grammatically, syntactically, are so incredibly far apart, it kind of frees you from having to even think about being faithful to, you know, word order, word choice, kind of the stuff that I don't necessarily think is the most important thing in the book, particularly a book like that. So I could be instead faithful to, you know, tone or the atmosphere, the mood, something like that. So yeah, I think it was definitely a more liberated process.
I mean, so I suppose from a language like Korean, it would be even more interesting to see a few translations of the same thing, because the ability to go in different directions in the prose is probably more pronounced.
Yeah, I think so. But I think mainly it would be as well what you're choosing to be faithful to primarily as a translator, because you could attempt to be more faithful to the sentence structures in Korean, even the you know, paragraph structures sometimes, because it's a very contextual language. You will have often sort of quite a long chunk and only sort of seems to be referring to something, but the way in which sort of pronouns are used, you can refer to something without having already sort of established what it is, and then at the very end you will say what it is. Whereas in English, you kind of need to tell the reader what is being discussed first before you then move on to discuss it a lot of the time. So you could be, yeah, faithful to completely different aspects of the book, and that would produce quite a radically different translation. So yeah, it was just one choice, I guess.
Well, I think we should probably open out to questions from everyone else, unless one of you had something burning that you wanted to say before we did. No. So it'd be great if anyone has a question or something that they'd like to add to the discussion. The only thing, apparently, you really have to make sure you talk into the microphone, otherwise people don't hear you. Well, yes, yeah. I think there's a microphone coming.
Then you have to start thinking more. The rule is if you don't ask questions, we start asking you questions. This is how it works.
Hello, yes. Good evening. Thank you very much. That was fascinating. This book, the poetry, two books that you have, those two books, are they by, they're not by the same translator?
They are. They're completely the same except for the two rather.
I was going to ask you to compare them, compare the translation, but obviously.
Yeah.
Was there any change? No.
No, they're completely the same.
They're identical.
Just a different typeface, that's
okay,
all.
Thank you.
Thank you for the very, very interesting discussion. When you talk about translating into a good English style or creating, you know, a work in English, which, you know, I thoroughly agree with this in principle, but what about the possibility of so-called improving the text? I mean, this is something which sometimes translators can be accused of making a better text than the one that actually existed in the original. Maybe you think that doesn't matter at all.
Deborah, would you like to talk about improving the text? No.
No, not really.
I know Danny likes to talk about improving the text.
Well, one thing I can say, I was going to say in our defence, I don't really mean in our defence. I think in some ways it's slightly different if you're working into English to if you're working into other languages. This is a massive generalization, but I think there is some truth in it. And I mean it just in one way, which is we translate very little into English compared to out of English into other directions. What this does mean is that for the most part, those of us who translate don't get asked to translate rubbish. We don't mostly get asked to translate things that are really bad. One of the things you will find, obviously there are exceptions, no one in this room, one of the things you find if you go to a bookshop in France is there is an enormous amount translated from English, including a lot of really bad things, things that were fairly bad to begin with. And there's massive discrepancy. There's a huge amount of volume. For the most part, if you have a very small number of books being translated from, as it may be, Korean in this case, they're going to be, they will have been fought over, they will have been carefully selected and so forth. So in one sense, I think we do have the advantage that I've never at least been asked to translate a book, read it and thought, this needs some work. Obviously, they're not always to my taste, they're not always perfect, but for the most part, you sort of know what the rationale for this book existing is, which is not the case for every book, certainly, at least for me. There is a sort of flip side to that, which is one of the things that makes it slightly difficult translating into English is there is an editorial culture which is very different here to a lot of places. And what I do certainly find is I get asked to translate books that may be really good bits of fiction writing in Spanish or Portuguese or French, but which no one has ever edited. Mm. And there is then a slightly more delicate process of working with the publisher here and an author in, as maybe, Lisbon, where the publisher reads the translation because they've never read the book before. When you give them the translation, it's the first time they've read the book most of the time. And they may say, obviously, this is very good, but what the hell happened to the subplot? There was a really big subplot in the first quarter of the book, and where have all these characters gone? Or clearly, chapter 7, I can tell he thinks it's funny, but it's not really funny. You know, the kind of fairly big, quite significant edits tend not to happen in at least the languages I translate from, for the most part. So that, while I think we're talking on, for the most part, translating into English and working with really good writers and writers who you can see what they're trying to do, and all you can do is try and make something as good as what they've done. You don't want to mess about with it. There is sometimes that very particular problem, which is a writer I translate, a very good writer whom I shall not name, put something on Facebook about 2 years ago. It was, I think, the third week of April, saying, I'm really excited, I'm nearly done with novel X. And I wrote and said, that's very exciting, when's it going to be out? And he wrote back and said, I think probably June sometime. Publishers in the room. Which means this is not a book that's going to be edited. It's a book that's going to go to the publisher, and they will more or less check your spelling if they have the time. In this particular case, he is a writer who's incredibly controlled and incredibly economical, and he produced something which is fantastic and didn't need massive work. But that is sort of symptomatic of the way a lot of cultures think of the editing process. It's very hands-off. You don't invade the territory of the individual creative genius. I mean, you wouldn't presume to tell them how to write their novel. And so there is sometimes that process of jostling which needs to happen to get something to the standard, the particular kind of editorial standard that's expected from a publisher in this country.
But of course that happens in the UK too. As a translator, I've known some books have much more of an edit and attention than other books. Mm. And it's just with two Argentine novelists that we've published, Yossi Havilio's first book, Open Door, he was horrified because his publisher, a small and independent in Argentina, really sort of worked on it for ages with him, but it turned it into this very tight book. Whereas the other Argentine we published, Carlos Gamero, he realized when we came to publish The Islands that it was about 150 pages more than he actually wanted. Mm. So he with us went and cut it by 150 pages because he realized he hadn't really had an edit the first time around. Mm.
Yeah. I think it's particularly difficult to talk about improving as well when you're translating from not just a language that is very different, but a literary culture that is also very different and has come from a completely different tradition. So there will be features that Korean readers will think of as good writing that English readers will not think of as good writing. So repetition, for instance, there's a lot more repetition in Korean than there is in English. And you have to remove that because it sounds like bad writing in English. But is that improving? I mean, how is that different from just translating, from creating the version that is in English? And then if you translated that translation sort of in a more literal way back into Korean, it's not improved because the Korean reader isn't going to think it's better because it's not for them, it's for the English reader. So I think it's kind of difficult to even think of what
would constitute improving in that sense.
But there is also a kind of imperial thing about really what we need is we want Chinese novels that are kind of like our novels.
Yeah.
We don't want them to be too long or too short or structured in a different way. We want Arabic writing that is sort of basically like the kind of novels we write in English. And there is that process of attempting to squeeze something into a form that we feel comfortable with, that our publishers think they can sell.
I think a lot of the metaphors used for talking about translation are very annoying.
yes, so they are.
I mean, I think especially the two that really upset me are kind of when it's the praise of the smooth translation and the free translation, you know, that it flows freely. Mm. And I think in both cases, that kind of it's the improvement that you're talking about, which is not improvement, where there's an ideal of a very neutral English style. Mm. And I think that repetition is fascinating because I think also it can go the other way. You know, like certainly into French, English actually can be. You can do effects with repetition, and then I've noticed with being translated into French or other languages, suddenly then that's being ironed out because they say you just sound kind of mad to a French reader. And but then the other problem can be when you are like I think what's interesting is often why you want to translate a text is because it is an original style in its and that will mean that it's deformed slightly normal usage. Mm. And the thing that really kind of gets to me is when, as it were, that deformation of the normal usage is then being replaced by something freer because apparently it sounds odd. And again, I suppose it comes back to the worry about authority we're talking about, this, the worry that it will sound just like a bad translation.
It's one of the reasons why we're sort of reassured by what literary translators are reassured by Google, because the way Google works, Google Translate, is based on previous usage and probability and using this enormous corpus. And actually, in many ways, the most interesting writing is the stuff that's going to be using things in different ways and using rhythms and syntax.
Sort of common sort of questions when I'm translating something that seems unusual to me is to ask native speakers, you know, does that sound as odd to you in Portuguese as I think it does?
And then if it does, you need to make it sound strange in English. Mm. Yeah. But I think also there is a cultural thing as well where bad texts can become good. I mean, like the canonical example is Poe, I think, where maybe there are people who can disagree, but I find Poe an absolutely risible writer. Mm. Like a kind of, like just terrible and kind of always amazed that then when you read, you know, kind of Baudelaire's translations, Mallarmé's translations, they've completely changed. And it's not that they're mistranslating, but it's that in a completely different context. I mean, slightly, I think I've always been interested with Baudelaire that he often slightly changes the register. So where Poe has something like the imp of kind of, he translates imp by demon, a démon, and suddenly that slightly kind of gives it an aggrandizing feel, and it's no longer this kind of cutesy, slightly annoying kind of folkloric thing, but it's suddenly into kind of Baudelaire's kind of system of philosophy. But I think that's an example where the cultural, there's something kind of by putting it into kind of a context of absolute literature, of kind of art for art's sake, and the way literature has been discussed in, Poe becomes a literally different writer, even though it's not been changed massively.
Mm. So maybe that is the example of the improving translation.
You could translate Poe in, I mean, you could do a version of Poe as well, presumably. You could do Poe in English.
Yeah.
I just thought that was a really interesting question, and I translate from Chinese, and I'm facing, I think it could be quite a major problem at the moment. It's series of journalistic pieces which are wonderful, and they're going to be really great. I can't wait to see them in translation, but I've never translated anyone who at times writes quite so badly. I mean, collocations are absolutely, I mean, as gross mistakes as saying, calling a table fat instead of big. And I just don't know what I'm going to do about it. I think probably I'm going to tidy up some of the more problematic things. I know he wrote in a hurry, just because what he writes is so amusing, so sharp, I really want it to be understandable. But I've never faced this problem before, and I really think it's quite tricky. I don't think it's because he writes so well that he's written so oddly. I think it's because he was writing in a hurry. So that faces me with ethical problem, I suppose. And since I'm only on the first draft, I don't quite know what I'm going to do about it.
Well, I mean, if they were written for a newspaper, I suppose they might not have had that edit.
I'm sure they didn't.
Anyone else? Right at the back.
Hello. When you work with a writer, are you in constant dialogue with him, or do you do your piece and then show? Do you work with the writer? Or?
When translating a book, do we...
always different. Yeah. It depends on the writer. When I was working with Hangang, I translated... first draft, polished it up into a final draft, and it was only in the editorial process that we actually had any direct contact, partly because this was the first time I was translating a book and I didn't really know what the convention was about that, and I didn't know her personally, so I think I would have chosen to be in contact sooner in that process. But then with other writers that I've translated since, especially who cannot read my my English version and sort of go through that with me, they're quite happy, or more happy, to say, just go away and, you know, deal with it. And they will answer, you know, specific factual questions some of the time. Some of the time they will say, you know, I wrote this book 10 years ago. I don't remember what I meant. So, you know, you have to go on the internet and find it out that way. So it depends. It depends on the book whether you want to know or not, sort of what their intentions were a lot of the time.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I've translated a few dead people recently, so there's limited options there. But
spiritualist.
I mean, most of the difficulties, I think, with translation are just getting it to be absolutely right in English, and that, you know, the author can't really help you with that. But now and then there are things where you're just a little unsure maybe about what it's really getting at, particularly if the language is very unusual. Then I think it is nice to be able to talk to the author.
I think I ask authors two different kinds of questions. I'm in touch with them a lot and quite regularly, and slightly kind of annoyingly, I suspect, writing them, I mean, not the dead ones so much, but writing the living ones stroppy emails at 3 o'clock in the morning saying, an anagram? Why did you need an anagram? Surely this chapter would have been fine without an anagram. I ask them, I guess, two different kinds of questions. One is, I actually don't understand what's happening here. There is a use of this word. I have no idea what you're trying to do, or there's a cultural reference which is not in Wikipedia, and that is the extent to which I'm able to do research nowadays. And I actually need you to explain something for me, and unless you explain it to me, I'm going to be really stuck. I've asked as many native speakers as I can, and you are the last resort. But there is another kind of question which I do ask quite often, which is, because I'm fortunate to have writers almost exclusively who have quite good English, and all of them write, I mean, every book I've translated has been by a writer who has been available to me and willing and very, very helpful. But the thing I tend to ask them is, the thing which you almost never can translate, I'm not going to go into what you can and what you can't, except to say, ambiguity is very difficult. Because it won't. You can have a word in one language whose main meaning is the same roughly as a word in the other language roughly, but the kind of various not quite meanings they have will always be different. And what I will often find myself doing is writing to an author and saying, well, you've got this word which sort of is on the spectrum between these two things. I've got to choose one. And it's going to slightly tip the character this way or that way. Mm-hmm. I'm slightly inclined to this one just because it ends on a strong syllable and I want my sentence to end on a strong syllable. On the other hand, this one has... And so sometimes what I find myself doing is talking to an author and saying, I'm happy to do this myself, but you may have a view on which way we're going to go. Is this... you know, the word you've used means wait and hope, and you obviously kind of meant both, or you meant one but with an echo of the other. Can't do that in English. I'm going to have to plump for one or the other, and I can do this, but you may have a view about that. So I find increasingly that the things I consult the writers about are to do with having to make precise something which in the original was intentionally doing several things, and writers usually have views.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, because obviously I'm the other way around. I'm the writer who's being translated, and kind of, and I do get quite scared if suddenly the Korean translation arrives and you realize that the Korean translator has never been in touch with you. And it is interesting, I mean, like, because I think the nightmare for the author, as it were, is the one who thinks they speak the language and is trying to kind of help out with kind of... And the only one I could ever check like that would be French. And I try not to, because otherwise you get into a horrific argument. but I think what is interesting is actually how reassuring it is. And I think that I quite like being questioned. And often, partly why I think it's really interesting is because you realize often how many misunderstandings, you know, even with absolutely fluent translators who are writing you fluent emails in English, and are quite obviously highly intelligent people, they will have just completely not got something. They've just misunderstood. Their question reveals that they have absolutely not understood the sentence. And it's because of that.
That's always reassuring.
Well, no, but then, because then you can kind of discuss it. But what, yeah. So what's not reassuring is then when you realize if someone has assumed they've understood everything. And I think especially, and then the other thing I find interesting is how often, it's very similar to what we've been talking about, that I'm often actually, I think, encouraging the translator to be freer. And I think it's interesting, I think I'm the opposite to say Inga Christians, you know, that I'm often saying there is a formal trick here that I find much more important than the meaning. So I'd much prefer you to go away and change the meaning if we can keep that formal trick. So I think that I do quite like it if there's at least one email.
Sounds like a good tip for us translators.
Just the one.
A sort of comment about ambiguity and connotation and the difficulties and the quandaries that arise with that. I was struck by the during the reading the lovely reading about sex, that two words really, really popped out, and one was "you're in a rut," and the other one was, I think it was, "luster," and I found myself wondering, you know, well, in English, these are wonderful words in this context, and they're loaded with connotations. And, you know, what was the original? We'll never know. You know, was the translator selecting these words because there was a similar wordplay connotation elsewhere in the text? Did it happen accidentally? You know, all these things, we'll never know. But it worked. It worked beautifully. So, you know, there's so much that we'll never know about what gets lost and what gets added and what gets substituted, what gets changed. You know, how much is the translator's voice? How much is the author's voice? We have to accept what we're given. And in this case, it worked beautifully. I don't know if anybody else was struck by those particular words, but that's what struck me.
But I think that's interesting, again, to come back to this improvement. I mean, I think there can be completely unexpected. I have no idea if that was in, but it could, if say it weren't, that seems to me not, that's fine. I mean, I think that often, you know, given that a lot will go, I think one of the things to always remember is there will be compensatory moments when actually the text has got improved unexpectedly.
And something like that, it's, you know, it's an opportunity that the language you're working in has given you to do with that passage that may not be there in the original language, but that you can tell from the rest of the book that the author... that is an appropriate choice, that is a choice the author could have made themselves if they'd been writing it in English.
Chance.
Yeah.
Exactly. Oh, it may be somewhere else, but it may be 10 lines earlier, 20 lines later. Mm. One of the things you do, I think, quite deliberately, is you think, well, I still owe the reader a pun.
Yeah.
And I'm 8 lines later, and suddenly you find something, 2 things that rhyme, and think, yeah.
I remember I once heard a
tally.
I did a conversation on stage a couple of years ago with Julian Barnes about translation, and he told this wonderful anecdote about the translation of Flaubert's Parrot into German, where the translator had written to him, and there was a moment in Flaubert's Parrot where Flaubert is masturbating in Egypt. And the translator came back saying, well, there's an idiom in German which would for masturbating, which would translate as to shake the coconut from the palm tree. And Julian said, go, this is much better than, you know, this is perfect. This is kind of,
you don't really have bishops in Egypt, so maybe you like to think of that.
But I like to shake the coconut from the palm tree.
It's amazing what translations can do. Do we have... How are we doing for time?
We've got time for one more if there is one.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Thank you so much for that. There was a comment made very early on about two books that I think the Danish Book of Poetry had to wait several years before it got translated, and the book from Hindi, I think, was one of the first ones translated in a generation. So my question is, to what extent do you think translators' attempts into English become sort of representative of what Hindi or what Danish poetry should sound like to an entire generation of British readers?
It's tough, isn't it? Because you haven't got the other books to read. I don't know. I don't know if people would take Inger Christensen as representative or not. I
think it's inevitable in a way, and it's something that I'm aware of working from a language where there is not that much else in English. Not so much with this book and not so much in the translation, but when I'm pitching books to publishers, there are certain books that I think would be great in English, would be received well, are just, you know, sort of objectively great books, but maybe need to wait a little while until there have been a few more other translations from Korean available, and so they can not, there is the ability for them not to be seen as representative. There is also the danger of falling into a kind of rut or falling into publishers' expectations of wanting to publish something similar that has already been published and has done well, because that is the sort of inevitable conservatism of, you know, needing to sell them as well. But then as a translator, something that you can do, especially when you're working with a language where the editors, the publishers here can't read it, so it's what you bring to them rather than them being able to sort of go out, find these works and then ask, you know, me to translate them, is to choose things that are different, that aren't necessarily fitting a stereotype, or that will give, you know, that will allow a more varied or multiple or nuanced interpretation of what's going on there. And then obviously, again, as translators, we can't make the final decision. We can't make anything be published. But we can at least show the people who are making these decisions, you know, this is what's available. Nothing really is representative. And often, you know, what is representative, maybe what is, you know, mainstream in any literary culture, even in Britain, and is not necessarily, in fact, not usually what's exciting. Usually what's exciting is what's slightly outside of the representative mainstream. And so that's precisely what you want to be bringing over.
That seems like a good place to end the evening. Thank you, Deborah. Thanks.
I didn't mean you when I said publishers and conservatism and all that stuff.
No, we're not publishers. No.
Well, thank you, all of you, for such a lively and interesting discussion. I hope that everyone's got some new and diverse reading material for the new year, and you'll all go out and try and find these four wonderful books. And think more widely about what we might be reading. And now, before I invite you all to have a glass of wine next door, I have to do the boring thing and remind everybody that Asymptote's fundraising campaign closes in only 9 days. So I have a final plea for you. The magazine, I'm afraid, is not affiliated with any institution or university, and the team is too geographically diverse to qualify for most funding options. Unfortunately, the publishing the very best in international literature is not without cost, and we're very quickly running out of resources. So only with your support can we continue to provide readers with free online access to all of our content, which we very much want to do. So please do visit our Indiegogo campaign page before the 29th of January and consider making a donation in exchange for some very exciting perks. But more importantly, thank you everyone very much for this evening. Can we please thank our panelists?